from the Edwin Cardinal O'Brien Pastoral Center in Washington, D.C., home base for the Archdiocese for the Military Services USA. This is Catholic Military Life, a podcast of the Archdiocese. I'm your moderator, Taylor Henry. And for this edition, it's my great pleasure to welcome to our microphones the Reverend Mr. Jacob George, a transitional deacon scheduled to be ordained a priest later on this year. Jacob, welcome to our microphone.
Thank you, Taylor. It's good to be here.
And now you have been working here in the Edwin Cardinal O'Brien Pastoral Center for the last 6 months or so in the tribunal. You are currently working on getting a JCL, becoming a canon lawyer through the Catholic University right across the street. You're born in India, and you're 35 years old. Or are you 36 now?
Oh, no, still 35, I'm afraid. Yeah.
35. Okay, in that 35 years, you come from India all the way to sitting in front of this microphone talking to me about your becoming a priest in the spring. Fill in the gap for me. How did you get from there to here?
Yeah, sure. So I was born in India, but I never really lived in India. So my mother, my parents are both from India. They grew up in Bangalore, although they're originally from Kerala, which is the southernmost state of India. And they lived in the UAE, but when my mother was pregnant with me, she went back to Bangalore, India, to be with her mother so that she would be around when I was born. But then when I was 3 months old, I came back to Dubai with my mom. So I've never really lived in India. So I lived in Dubai all the way through to the end of high school. After high school, I took a year off and I did mission work with a group called the Community of Grace. Then I came to the U.S. I went to Purdue University to do an undergraduate degree in aeronautical engineering, although I later switched to mechanical engineering. After I graduated, I came back to Dubai and I worked in the oil and gas industry for a few years, for 4 years. Then I worked for a year in the vicariate office, so the Office of Communications for the equivalent of a diocese of the Arabian Peninsula, the southern vicariate of the Apostolic Vicariate of Southern Arabia. That's what's the official title. And then in 2017, I came back to the U.S. to attend seminary at Mount St. Mary's Seminary in Emmitsburg, Maryland. I just finished my seminary studies in May 2023, so just under a year ago.
So here you are.
And then I ended up coming here to the AMS to help out with the tribunal work as a sort of internship to the canon law degree that I started 2 summers ago.
I see.
Yeah.
Are you a cradle Catholic?
Yes. Yes, cradle Catholic.
So you were growing up in the UAE, the United Arab Emirates.
Yeah.
There are Catholics there, right?
There's lots of Catholics. So there's about maybe 700,000 to 800,000 Catholics in the UAE.
In a predominantly Muslim country.
That's right, yeah.
Are you ethnically Indian or are you Arab or what is your ethnic background?
I'm ethnically 100% Indian.
I see, okay.
Yeah.
All right, very interesting. Okay, so how is it that you wound up at the Archdiocese for the Military Services?
Sure, yeah. So, I guess the thing that started it all was this canon law degree that I started studying for at the COA. So 2 summers ago, so that's June 2022, me and another seminarian, Joel Phillip, we both enrolled through our bishop at the time, Bishop Paul Hinder, and for the Community of Grace, we enrolled in the summer canon law program, which the COA offers. So you go there for 4 summers and take class as a full-time student. And at the end of 4 summers, you're done with the JCL studies. So we started that 2 summers ago. Last summer, because of various things that came up, I wasn't able to take classes. But then what the canon law school recommended was that I work in a tribunal. And Monsignor Jenkins, who is the dean of canon law, said a good place to start would be the AMS tribunal because they're often looking for interns. So I approached the tribunal here, and that's kind of how I ended up.
I see. Here. Now, you're not a chaplain candidate, at least not yet, right?
No, I'm not.
Have you ruled out the possibility of becoming a military chaplain, or is that something that you would consider down the road after you're ordained a priest this year?
Well, yeah, it's something I'm certainly open to, but not immediately, at least.
Because, I see. Well, none of our chaplain candidates immediately go into the service.
Exactly, yeah.
And when they get out of seminary, it's usually 3 years in their home diocese, and then they can go on military duty. I can share with our listener, just from my personal experience with you here, especially since you were ordained a transitional deacon back in December, and you have started giving the homilies at the noon mass, and very, very inspiring homilies and reflect a great deal of insight and reflection on your part, a lot of depth for someone who's only 35 years old. Okay, I'm over 65, so you'll have to forgive me. But and you're working on the JCL, the canon law degree, and that's on top of how many other degrees you have besides mechanical engineering?
Yeah, so I have the Bachelor of Science in Engineering from Purdue. While I was in seminary, the seminary over here, Mount St. Mary's, they offered the opportunity to do multiple degrees at the same time. So so I have a Master of Divinity from the Mount, but then I also did a MA, a Master of Arts, with a specialization in Scripture, which is really my passion. I love Scripture. And then there was also the STB, which is a theological degree of pontifical, right? Like that comes from Rome, you could say.
I see. Well, already in your young life, academically well accomplished, and as I said, it shows. You obviously have a bright future as a Catholic priest. The folks who will be in your flock will be very blessed to have you as their shepherd.
Oh, thank you.
So you grew up in UAE. Well, that's in hot spot, right there in the Persian Gulf or the Arabian Gulf, depending right. on your perspective, which the Navy, U.S. Navy, is frequent visitors to that part of the world. In fact, pretty much maintains a steady presence there. What are your thoughts when you know your background as being a native to that area, a citizen, not in the military, but surely growing up you were aware of all the naval activity and the conflicts going on, the tension between the U.S. and Iran in the Persian Arabian Gulf. What was that like for you when you would hear about the news accounts of these ships moving back and forth, the U.S. Navy warships in the Gulf?
Yeah, I guess growing up, I wasn't as sensitive, I'd say, to the happenings between the U.S. and Iran, except when it came to the oil and gas business. So I worked for a couple of companies that specialized in hydraulics on oil rigs, and so very often. Companies from Iran, the Persian companies, would set up what we call front companies in the UAE so that they're able to do business as a non-Persian company. So we often did business with companies like that. We were often sensitive to the interests of our American clients when we worked with Persian clients. So we would keep an eye on what the law was in terms of business relations between U.S. companies and contractors and Persian companies, just so that we wouldn't have disruption in our relations with our American clients by, you know, helping Persian front companies. So, but in terms of, I feel like maybe you were asking more in terms of the political tensions that might have overflowed into the UAE because of the naval activity. And in that sense, you really don't feel much in the UAE. It's such a tourist-oriented hospitality, you know, thinking country that you don't really feel the tensions of the neighboring countries, you know, because of the political unrest.
That's surprising because the Gulf is, on the larger scheme of things, not all that big. I mean, you've got numerous countries surrounding that body of water and countries that have different ideological priorities. And that's interesting that growing up there and then going back there professionally, it's not top of mind.
Right. The countries are all pretty well siloed off each other. So like the UAE is a tiny country. It's one of the smallest, I think, after Bahrain and maybe Kuwait, the smallest countries in the Arabian Peninsula. But it's so different from its neighbors. Like, so for example, if you just look at the UAE and its neighbor, Saudi Arabia, you know, those two countries share borders. Just the attitude of the government towards the church is completely different in those two countries. In the UAE, we have, as you said, 700,000 to 800,000 Catholics, and there are not many parishes. There's, I think, now 9 parishes in the country. But because you've got such a high number of Catholics and so few parishes, you end up with these mega churches. So the church I grew up in has about 300,000 parishioners, which is the size of like a normal diocese here in the U.S.
That's the size of a mid-sized city.
Yeah, so that was the situation for the church in the UAE. But then you go over the border to Saudi Arabia, and there is no church, you know, and the church works underground there because it's illegal. But you would never feel that being in the UAE. So that's just like to give you an example of how different these countries are, which are all within the same peninsula.
Very interesting. I spent some time in Bahrain back in the 80s, and I was delighted to find a Catholic church there where I could attend Mass, but Catholics are in the minority. And but I never felt like I shouldn't, you know, practice my faith. And I'm glad to know that in the UAE, there's no government suppression of Christianity or Catholicism.
Yeah.
So when did you first get the idea that maybe you should be a priest?
So the first time that crossed my mind was in fourth grade. So I went to a Catholic high school in Dubai, St. Mary's Catholic High School. And in fourth grade, our class teacher, Miss Joan Harrison, she was a very devout Catholic woman. And one day she was teaching us something. I think she might have been teaching us math. You know, she must be writing something on the blackboard. She suddenly just turned around and asked, I was just wondering, how many of you sitting here would like to be priests when you grow up? And looking back, that's the first time I can actually recall thinking seriously about that possibility existing, you know, that maybe I could become a priest. So I thought about it for maybe 2 seconds, and then I raised my hand. Ever since then, it's always been at the back of my mind that, you know, I think you're called to be a priest. So it was never in a haunting way, but in kind of a very reassuring way that, you know, eventually you will become a priest. So don't forget that. And it didn't really disturb me, but it was in a way something I looked forward to.
So fast forward a number of years, you go to Purdue University, you get a degree in mechanical engineering. You're a smart fellow. not just anybody can get a degree in mechanical engineering.
Well, I got them to believe it.
And so from there back to UAE and working in the oil and gas industry, I mean, what is it about working in the oil and gas industry that opens you to the spirit?
Yeah, so there's another piece to the whole puzzle, which is kind of was an undercurrent through college and work, which is my association with this community called the Community of Grace, which started in the UAE in Dubai, when three brothers, we call them, came from India to the UAE with the intention of doing mission work, but in a very subtle and discreet way. So they were professionals, so they would work, and then in the evening they would gather families and pray together. And my family was one of the families that got involved, and I was very moved or struck by this particular charism of these people, which was very strongly rooted in scripture. So I first came in contact with them when I was in about 10th grade, and I was very drawn by them. And, so after I finished high school, I decided I want to take a year off to work, just do mission work with these guys. Yeah. So I did that. We traveled. So I was able to travel to several countries around the world to help them with mission work, which ranged from, you know, visiting families to conducting retreats or conventions or parish missions and things like that in Northeast India, in other parts of the Middle East, in Europe, in North America. So I was very drawn by this charism of the community. And so it was at that time that I felt, I think if God wants me to be a priest, he's going to make me a priest of this community. So I expressed that interest to these brothers of the community, and they were fine with that, except that they reminded me that there was no way to do that within the community. There was no canonical path that I could take which would allow me to be a priest of the Community of Grace, which was still kind of finding its structure canonically just as a community. So I mean, reflecting on that, I felt, well, I do feel very strongly about this, so I'm not in a rush to be a priest, so I can wait. Yes, and in the meantime, I'm just going to do what you guys are doing. So I got a degree, became a professional, worked, and whatever I earned, just like the other brothers who were involved in the community, we held in common and spent towards the mission that we were doing around the world. So that's how I was able to go to college, study, then come back and work while still keeping that vocation to the priesthood alive. You know.
So this Community of Grace you got involved in before you went to Purdue.
Yes.
And then you came back and working full time in the oil and gas industry in Dubai, UAE. And you're doing this missionary work on the side. How many hours in the day? I mean, you must have just been working all the time. Do you ever get any sleep?
Oh, yeah. So it was, I guess I didn't think too much about the number of hours I spent on each thing. But yeah, we would work hard, you know. And but it's like, you know, time flies when you're having fun. Or I think it was Fulton Sheen who said you work best when you are in the presence of the beloved, you know. So when it came to mission work, there was always an extra energy that came from somewhere, you know, that allowed you to do things even after a full day's work and things like that.
Wow, that's really an inspiring story, Jacob.
Oh, thanks, Taylor.
That you would work in the oil and gas industry. I'm sure you're making a good bit of money. And you put that in a kitty, you know, a collective fund. Wow. I mean, that sounds like the early Christians.
Yeah, that's kind of what the model that the community was trying to base itself off.
And it shows real commitment on your part. It's almost unheard of that folks in the United States would do that, you know, aside from the most reverent of us, you know. Well, so being ethnically Indian, although you didn't live there for a long time, we've all heard the story about the Apostle Thomas, the Doubting Thomas, who, according to legend, after the death of Christ and his resurrection, went to India. Have you researched how these stories came about? Is that true, or is that just something somebody made up?
Oh, no, we believe it's very true. So when St. Thomas came to India and converted some very high-profile Hindus, I think which we would call Brahmins, which inspired, you know, the conversion of certain communities. And that's where the roots of Christianity started in India. And the rite that kind of flows from that is now called the Syro-Malabar rite. And there are some other branches like the Syro-Malankara rite. And they still have, so they're one of the Eastern rites of the Catholic Church, and they still have their own liturgy, and they still are still very much alive and active in South India, and are really even now providing priests all over the world. So you have Syro-Malabar priests even here in the U.S., but also in Europe and Germany and even in the UAE, you know, so there is an abundance of vocations there and priests, even though it's the religion, Christianity, is a minority in India. So one of my uncles, actually my grandfather's brother, was also a priest and later became a bishop and a cardinal, and was named the head of the Syro-Malabar Church. So his name was Cardinal Varki Vidyathil.
This is your uncle?
This is my granduncle, so my grandfather's right. Brother.
I see.
Yeah, so so we certainly believe that St. Thomas coming to India is true.
Well, what is the evidence for that? Not recently, but going by memory, they even believe they know where he's buried. Is that true?
Yeah, so they believe his remains are in Chennai in India, so there's a cathedral there where his remains are, and it's one of the few sites in the world where we know where the remains of one of the original apostles were.
Him and St. Peter.
Him, St. Peter, St. James in Spain, in Santiago. So there's a few, there's some of apostles we don't know where the remains are, but I know those are three, for example, that we do.
Now, the legend has it that St. Thomas, the apostle, was martyred in India. Is that true, or do you know?
Yeah, but to be honest, I'm not totally familiar with martyrdom story. Yeah,
But even back then, by the time he would have arrived in the early or mid, I suppose, first century, India was already Hindu. Hinduism was well established even at that time in India.
Yeah, Hinduism is a pretty ancient religion.
I see. Well, so what's in the future for the Reverend Mr. Jacob George? You'll be ordained when, in May?
May the 4th.
I see.
God willing, of course.
And then we will lose you here at the Archdiocese for the Military Services, at least temporarily.
At least temporarily. I hope to be able to come back. So as of now, the goal is to continue canon law studies here at the CUA, but then also continue working here, probably not full-time anymore, but part-time at least, while pursuing the degree.
So you'll continue your canon law studies even after you're ordained a priest?
Yeah.
You have another year to go?
At least.
I see.
Maybe another 2 years.
Or you might get a doctorate.
Oh, I hope not.
Well, I can understand that, because that's a lengthy dissertation that would take up a lot of your time.
Yeah, as I can see, my good boss is doing that.
And I suppose the point of becoming a canon lawyer is down the road, you'll be able to assume the position of judicial vicar somewhere, right?
Not necessarily. That's certainly not the the primary intention. For me, the intention for canon law is to be able to assist the community of grace with its own canonical journey as it continues to grow and expand in the church.
So you're still very much involved with the community of grace.
Yeah,
still. Is the community of grace seeking members to join? Is this the kind of thing that you can, or is it more of a closed type of family oriented?
Well, it's I wouldn't call it closed, but it's constantly the mission of the community is evangelization, and so it's constantly on the move doing its mission work, and then on the journey those who are feel called to the particular charism of the community are always most welcome to come and ask us, and that's how they get involved.
And most of the folks who belong to the community of grace are lay people. This is a lay organization.
Yes, yeah. So I would be, if the ordination goes through, and on May 4th, I would be the second priest to come from the community. So everyone else is lay, almost everyone.
And do you anticipate staying in the United States, or will you go back to the United Arab Emirates?
I am open to anything, but I'm not sure what exactly is going to happen, because there's lots of pieces involved, but I would be open to both, and kind of waiting for the Lord to clarify that.
I see. Do you have dual citizenship?
No.
I see. So you're a citizen of the UAE.
I'm a citizen of India.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Very interesting. And now canon law, as I'm sure our listener knows, deals heavily with the issue of marriage. Whether it be weddings involving folks who have an irregular past, either a previous marriage or some impediment that has to be overcome in order to be married in the church. And then, of course, there are annulments, which probably is a major share of what you have to deal with. What other issues in canon law do you deal with? Are those mainly it, or are there other things that come up from time to time?
No, that pretty much covers it. So in the we're dealing with marriages for marriage paperwork of people who are wanting to get married, or marriage paperwork of people who are seeking to have their marriage declared null. That covers most of the work that I'm doing there.
I see. And each of those cases requires some analysis and research and gathering evidence. A lot of work involved per case.
Yeah, they can be pretty involved at times. Sometimes they're quicker. There's cases that will be done in as quickly as a week. There are cases that will take years, or usually not more than 2 years, but anything between 8 months to 16 months or so.
And how has doing this kind of work affected your faith life?
Oh, it's I really appreciate this kind of work, because it does give me a very unique and kind of intimate picture on married life. You know, in a way that I had never examined in such detail before. Yeah, so it just so happens that very often they are quite tragic stories, but then at the same time, just the fact that someone is seeking a declaration of nullity shows some sort of turn to the faith. So although the cases often deal with tragic histories, they very often also deal with, you know, joyful realities that are present, you know, that they're seeking to be in proper state or in proper stance with the church.
I've been talking to the Reverend Mr. Jacob George, who is working here at the Archdiocese for the Military Services, Edwin Cardinal O'Brien Pastoral Center, in the tribunal. And the Reverend Mr. George will be ordained a priest in May. Jacob, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you, Taylor. It's been a pleasure.